Welcome to The Break Breakdown, a podcast from Queensbird Films. I'm your host, Courtney Romano. The Break Breakdown launched in August 2020 of last year. Obviously, it's 2021 now. And it came about as kind of a way to investigate what it means to get your big break. This thing that I've been noodling on for literally 15 years or so. How do you get your big break? How do you break into the industry, whatever that capital I industry is for you? And then once you get in there, how do you break it down and reshape it from the inside out? So this podcast was always meant to be kind of a leveling of the playing field in a lot of ways. We talked about Screen Test, which was the short film that we made in 2020. And we wanted to investigate, you know, okay, I was 35 years old, I had a one-year-old at home, and then I made a film for the first time, having basically no experience other than being an actor in commercials, which is not the same as directing a film. And Screen Test was our short film. I interviewed the actors and some of our creative team. And what this podcast has really turned into, beyond just this exploration of the behind the scenes of Screen Test, it's kind of turned into this siren call for anyone who wants to go rogue. If you are someone who has never felt exactly at home in the traditional kind of classic institutionalized space of your industry, you know, whether that's film or theater or journalism or dance or music or photography or education, business, medicine, like truly whatever industry you're in. This podcast is meant to explore the alternative route, the third way. It's really funny. So my child is 2 now, and if you are around kids or you have kids, you know this thing happens when they're 2 where you have to kind of give them 2 choices. You say, all right, do you want, you know, mommy to give you lunch or do you want daddy to give you lunch? Because the baseline is you're going to get lunch. And I've been doing this with my kid, and she's so smart, like outwitting me, because she always chooses the third way. It'll be like, do you want mommy to give you lunch? Do you want daddy to give you lunch? No, I want breakfast. And I don't want to tell her, like, I want to keep that instilled in her. Like, I don't want to get in the way of that natural instinct she has to take the third way, because I'm like, ooh, this is going to be good for you later on. Because there is a third way. There is an alternative route. We do not live in a binary. Choices are not so starkly one way or the other. There's always something else lurking around the corner that could help us. And that's why this podcast really exists. Let's find the third way together. Let's learn from each other. Let's make it an equitable space where we're sharing information. We're not gatekeeping information. Let's get more voices and more voices and more stories and more stories told. And that's really what Queensbird Films is about and what this podcast, The Break Breakdown, is about. So I'm really happy you're here. And I just want to say, I feel like I haven't been able to say this yet. And I just want to say thank you to everyone who is listening, who's tuning in, who's texting me, who posts on Instagram, and especially if you've left a review. I cannot tell you how amazing that is. It is just like, because most times you feel like you're screaming, or if you listen to my last episode about motherhood, crying into a void. And, you know, the reviews from an online perspective are really great because they help other people find us. If you review on Apple Podcasts, we kind of go up in the charts and more people can find us and more people can tune in. But they're also like on an emotional, physical, human level, just like a little high five. Like you're on mile 2 of a 26.2 mile marathon and your friend is standing there with a sign that like makes you feel really great about yourself and you know, just knowing that you can do it, that you can keep going. And so knowing that you're out there and you're listening and that you're reviewing and sharing this with people is just, I just wanted to say thank you because it really, it means just so much to me. So thank you. Okay, I wanted to tell you, just give you a quick little note about Queensbird Films, because we haven't totally talked about Queensbird Films, but you might have noticed in the cover art, it says The Break Breakdown, a podcast from Queensbird Films, and you might see it in the show notes and not really know what that's all about. So in 2020, when I was working on the film behind the scenes in pre-production and then also in post when we were editing during lockdown, I started Queensbird Films as kind of an umbrella of sorts, because I knew Screen Test was my first short film that I was going to make, but I knew that I was going to make more, and everything could just kind of live under that umbrella. So I am really excited to share that Screen Test by Queensbird Films got into two film festivals this past April. I am just super excited about it. I've been an actor for a long time, and a dancer and a performer, which is a very singular track. You know, you work with an ensemble, you work with a team, but you're kind of bringing one piece to that puzzle. And working as a director and writer on this, and producer, and bringing all the people together, the cast and the crew and the creative team together, and then having their work be recognized in these festivals just made me feel great. Like, I didn't expect, to be honest, I thought I was going to feel more like me-centered about it, but getting into those two film festivals just gave me such an abundance of gratitude for our team, because it does not happen on your own. You cannot do it on your own. I mean, I suppose some people are really talented and can do it on their own, but I am not able to do it on my own. And the people who came together to do Screen Test, I'm just like forever indebted and so grateful and so proud of everything that they did on this. And so I just wanted to shout that out, because I feel like they deserve it and their work deserves it. And Screen Test is going to be playing next month in June at the Queens World Film Festival. It's going to be playing online as an official selection, and then it's also been named a finalist in the New York Flash Film Festival. And we'll see what else happens, but if nothing else happens with film festivals this year, I am just so proud of the team, and just sharing that with you. The next project that we're going to work on is an 8-episode series. It's a dark comedy, something I've been writing for the past 5 years or so. It's like one of those things where you're writing it and you don't really know what it's about until 5 years later you look at the page and you're like, oh, I know exactly what this is about. And I had no idea at the time. So I'm not going to say too much about that, because we're still in pre-production. There's a lot going on, a lot of moving pieces. But if you want to stay up to date on that and anything that's going on with Screen Test, the best thing that you could do is sign up for our newsletter, the Queensbird Films List newsletter. The link for that sign up is in the show notes, and you can sign up for that newsletter. I only email about once a month. Usually it has a little anecdote, any news, and a roundup of podcast episode releases in case you've missed it. And in the future, there will be more production news, casting calls, crew calls, all kinds of cool stuff, ways to get involved and to participate. Okay, Joanna Carpenter. I am so excited to share this conversation with you. Joanna is an actor and an activist. She is an incredible multi-hyphenate. She is an actor. She's a singer. She is an athlete. She founded 86 The Barrier, which is this organization working to decolonize language and hospitality and provide equal access to professional growth and financial independence for all hospitality workers. So she's like deep in the hospitality industry as well. She really kind of touches all of these exciting and interconnected industries. And, you know, she's just someone who is both unapologetic and warm, which I just find to be like the best, most captivating combination of a person, when they're like, I do not apologize for who I am, and I don't want you to either. You know, they just have that kind of energy about them. That's Joanna. She is funny. She is charming. She's strong. Like, she's someone who's, you know, if you're in your presence, you just, in her presence, you just want to like straighten your spine and lean in to hear what she has to say. And she had so many amazing things to say about, number one, teaching me what it means to decolonize language and helping me kind of unlearn, like in real time, colonized language that is even in my brain and maybe I didn't realize it was even there. And I just think, what a skill, what a gift to be able to articulate and communicate that. Because if we're communicating better, if we're communicating in equitable ways, this is the first step. I forget, oh man, I'm going to butcher this quote, but Ocean Vuong, who's this incredible poet, they said something like, we have to speak worlds into existence before we can build them. Something like that. And it's so true, because speaking, communicating is the first chance we have to bring something inside our own brains out into the physical world. And that's the first kind of initiation of the idea. And if we can create like the link from our brains to our mouths out into the physical world, if those can be more equitable pathways and we can have a more inclusive and equitable conversation with each other, then we are laying a foundation for the change that we want to make in our industries, in our world, for everything. So I think what Joanna is doing with 86 The Barrier is just so cool, like so profound. You know what I mean? Just profound. So she talks a lot about that, teaches me a lot about that. She also talks about the temptation to make your process public on social media and why she doesn't make her process public, which I think is fascinating, especially for actors who often feel like they gotta show. And she talks about how to find your own voice, and then also her advice to anyone looking to break into the film and TV and theater industry who doesn't really know where they might fit. And I think her advice is really great. And yeah, I just love talking to her. I think she's awesome. I think she has a lot to give in multiple areas. I am so excited to share her story and words with you. And I know you're going to love her. And here she is. Well, Joanna, I'm really excited to talk to you, because I feel like I've known you from a distance for a year, because you were recommended to me by our dear mutual friend, Kennedy.
Ugh, and love him.
I feel the same way. And as I've kind of gotten to know your work peripherally, I can't wait to hear you talk about it, because it really feels like all the things that you're doing come directly from your heart and your brain, but really you're truly authentically you. But one thing that I wanted to start off talking about was, on your website, you have a list of books that you either recommend or that you love and have shaped you in some way. And on that list was The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. Mm-hmm. And the reason that jumped out at me was because I think I read that book at a time when like he was really speaking directly to me about a shadow career and yada, da, da, da. Mm-hmm. So I would just love to hear from your perspective, why that book, what impact did it make on you? And just tell me like, why is that one of the books on your website that you're like, listen, this book?
Yeah. First off, thanks for having me. super excited to be chatting. Second off, that book, it's interesting because there's not like, it's one of those books that once you read it fully the first time, I think you can kind of keep it with you for the rest of your life and open it up to any page, and it will present you with probably whatever you need to hear in that moment, whatever you need to read in that moment. And that's definitely what I've done with it. I've read it cover to cover twice. And every now and then I just pick it up and I'm like, universe, what do you need me to like get through my skull today? And it usually lands on something entirely prolific. And so there's not any one thing about the book that really struck me so much as it was the overall thing. The two things that stick with me the most are a pro, because he refers to people who take their craft seriously as pros, right? A pro just does it. Like, you just do it instead of making excuses to not do it, whatever your version of it is. And the other thing that I've really spent a long time noodling on is this kind of subliminal idea of the process being private, that has just like given me so many aha moments and so many light bulb moments and so much inspiration for how I carry myself on social media, in conversations, in my networks and my communities. The more time you spend talking about what you're doing, the less time you actually spend doing it. So right. I don't know if I'm allowed to curse, but like, shut the fuck up and do it. You know, those two things are just really like the golden threads that are integral to the tapestry that book weaves. And they are, for me, essential to how I approach things. Because, you know, being an artist is frightening and it's stressful, and you know, you wade into the deep end of the unknown a lot. And that book, I need everyone to read it, no matter what they do.
Yeah, I mean, what you're hitting on with the process being private is actually something that I've been thinking a lot about specifically yesterday and within this whole time period for sure. But as a writer and as a filmmaker, like a lot of what I do is never seen by anyone.
Yes.
And there's a pressure. And I think that's true too. Like even for actors, right? People aren't necessarily going to see your audition. People are not going to necessarily see you working on sides or doing the self-tape or reading the play that's helping you get a better understanding of the playwright and understand like what energy and you know, texture you need to bring to a thing. I mean, there's so
free, like,
yeah. I mean, there's so many things, not to even mention being an artist and needing to just live life to understand how to talk about life or express life.
Life. Yeah. Imagine.
Yeah. So like, I've been thinking a lot about that, and I think that's so key. And I think it's such a tension in how we live outwardly. You know, it's like we are, and I don't know if, you know, that list of white supremacist, like corporate culture, like, yeah. I'm sure you do because we'll talk about 86, the barrier later on, but like, I'm sure you're well aware. I don't know if it's on that list or not somewhere, or we could categorize it within that list. That's like, hey, these are the things that people do to hold up white supremacist thinking and culture. But I do kind of feel like the outwardness of it is somewhere on that list. The presentation of productivity, right? Which is on the list.
Ooh, the presentation of productivity. We're going to keep that. I like that.
Yeah. Cause that's what, I mean, every time I'm like, well, I should show, what do you want me to show? Like show me thinking in the shower and thinking like, what, how does that end? That doesn't make sense. I got to change the ending. Like, what am I going to show? You know,
especially when much of the good thinking happens in the shower. Like, I'm sorry. I do some of my best thinking in the shower. I'm not going to show that.
I mean, there are, I'm sure, some very great Instagram accounts of thinking in the shower, because what isn't there? Because capitalism. But, you know, what can we monetize here? But yeah, there's this tension I feel. And I think what you're hitting on with like the process is private, I think that is such a gold nugget of something like good, like for any kind of artist or arts worker to just be like, you are doing the work when you're engaged with it in the way that you engage with it. And no one else can tell you what that process is. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you feel any pressure to make your process public?
I do a little bit, and I always love having that dance with myself, that conversation with myself, because what I started to do quite some time ago was when I got the urge to display my work, display what I'm thinking in a moment, display how I'm feeling. I always pause and ask myself if that display is in service to the work and to the people that the work is supposed to be in service to. Or is it in service to my ego? Is it because I need some sort of external validation that I could maybe reach out to a friend and ask for, that I need some encouragement? You know, the dopamine release that we get from somebody liking one of our posts is directly correlated to how we craft those posts in the first place. Right. And as it comes to my display, my presentation of myself, especially on Instagram, because I'm not really on Facebook much anymore because it's a trash fire. Mm-hmm. On Instagram in particular, I think about the dual use of imagery and ethos. So if I'm going to post it, and like the algorithm loves our faces, right? Like the algorithm doesn't like pictures of food or like text-based things as much as it likes pictures of human faces. And so if I'm going to throw a picture of my face on my feed for people to presumably look at, and then couple it with some sort of like, you know, like usually an educational caption or something that's meant to be humanizing of something that's been dehumanized, or, you know, like me kind of taking a stand about something. I always have to think about like, what is this in service to? And if there's even the slightest inkling that it's in service to my ego in a way that is not self-deprecating, and this is very much my style, mm-hmm. Then I really try and like pull back on that. I don't need to display the anti-racist work that I'm doing, because I think of this in terms of spending emotional capital. We're living through a global pandemic and massive socioeconomic and sociopolitical upheaval. And so we're all dealing with a finite savings account emotionally. And if I'm going to spend emotional capital, I need to be very measured and intentional about how I spend it. I would much rather spend that emotional capital on silently doing the work and then choosing to speak when my voice is going to be valuable and of service, as opposed to spending the emotional energy going, look at all this work that I'm doing.
Yes. Yes. And I think, man, that it's like, it's bringing up so many things for me, and I'm just trying to figure out which direction I want to go in with it.
The buffet of options. We can talk about anything.
We can do all of it. Yes. The emotional capital. Also, you're talking about, I feel, two different things that we, or you're bringing up two different things that we contend with as artists on mm-hmm. social media.
Yes.
Our need to be, not everyone, not, I'm not saying that every artist is like, let me be anti-racist. There are certainly many, many, many racist and people out there who are arts workers. Yeah. But in what you're talking about, the need to kind of call attention to things that are really important, and like you said, have that kind of capital to be listened to by not putting out content all the time, but like, oh my gosh, Joanna's showing up, what's she saying? So that end of it. And then the other end of it, which, and I haven't acted in many years because I'm on this other side of things now, but from what I understand, needing to have thousands and thousands of followers to get casting to look at you.
Stupid.
Yeah. So how do you deal with that?
I don't. So that's an oversimplification. Let me pull back and clarify what I mean by that. I have been asked, especially because I work a lot on the commercial side, and like, you know, my agents are, I am just blessed with like the best team of agents ever. And very often they will send me, they'll be like, hey, we're going to submit you for this. If it's cool with you, they're asking for your Instagram account. And I'm always like, sure, they're going to find some pretty political shit on there. And I think there is merit in being a package that is marketable to the commercial sector. both on the theatrical side and on the television commercial side, you know, I think there's merit to that. However, I cannot extricate my political empathetic self from my artistic self. And that is what I have built my platform on. I'm deeply passionate about a lot of things, and I'm deeply passionate about people. And I refuse to present myself on social media as anything other than that authentic self, that hopefully generative, generous self. So my platform, I know, and I put platform in air quotes because I do not take myself that seriously. I really don't. But organically, I have 3,200 followers, 3,300 followers now, which, like, that's great, because since it's an organic following, I'm able to communicate messages with people that come from my authentic core. And if they want to follow me, they want to follow me. Nobody's making them do that. I do not like influencer culture. I do not like this culture that we have moved into where it's only Broadway stars to get the chance at TV. It's, and that's not, you know, that's not all the time, but like for like juicier roles on TV, it's influencers are now on the verge of being able to join SAG and get health and pension. And while I don't think that's a terrible thing, I think there's an imbalance there. So I kind of rail against influencer culture in a lot of ways. I have friends with massive followings who are really doing good work with those platforms, you know, calling anti-Semitism into the discussion and equity work and supporting women and women identifying humans. But like, when I've been in castings where they're like, oh, how's your Instagram following? I'm like, I'm right in front of you. Why do you care? I'm right in front of you doing the work, looking good, showing up, knowing how to take good photographs. Why do you care about my Instagram following? My work right here on camera should be enough to sell your product. And so I just like, I kind of like give it the middle finger, which is probably going to get me in trouble at some point, but I don't care.
Well, I feel like if it does get you in trouble at some point, you would make something of that. You'd be like, okay, well, let's learn from this.
I spent much of 2020 feeling like I was lighting my theatrical career on fire. So like, I'm just, you know what, like, whatever.
You know, and it's really true. I just interviewed, I don't know if you know Kimberly Dodson.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Just interviewed her a couple, it might've been a couple of weeks ago. It might've been last week. I don't remember.
It's not real.
Yeah. But she was talking about her organization, Everybody Black. Yeah. And how, you know, there were sometimes people who were like, ooh, this sounds great and I want to get involved, but I'm afraid, like you said, I'm going to light my theatrical career on fire. And it's, mm-hmm. I mean, it is a real thing of balancing. I mean, you know, I want to say political voice, but it's like, it's beyond that. Like your humanity, your quest yes. for dignity yes. and respect.
Yes.
Versus the marketplace.
Yes.
And, you know, art and capitalism are an interesting pair.
They really are.
And yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, do you foresee a path for yourself? Like, are you thinking like, okay, maybe I will, well, let's just get into what you're doing, because you're doing a lot of stuff.
Sure.
And my question was going to be like, what is the path through that where you get to be authentic and you still get to work? Like, what is that? But I feel like you're doing it. So you have your career as an actor. Mm-hmm. You have 86 The Barrier, which I'd love for you to talk about. And then you have also your anti-racism educational work.
Yeah.
So I guess you're doing it. I guess you're forging that path and finding the way. Can you talk, as we get into this, a little bit about 86 The Barrier?
Mm-hmm. So 86 The Barrier is very much a labor of love and fueled by indignation. So I've been in hospitality for over 17 years now. I've worked on all sides of the industry in almost all of the positions that you can work in a restaurant, with the exception of on the line. Nobody should ever put me on a chef's line. Dear God. And, you know, I come from a family of Chinese immigrants who, when they landed here, opened restaurants. And the, you know, the other half of my family built and operated a roller skating rink for 60 years, you know, so small business, hospitality, this is in my blood. I started working when I was in fourth grade at the skating rink, and I got my first restaurant job when I was like 16 or 17. I was like washing dishes and bussing tables at a local diner. And, you know, it was kind of my financial lifeblood when I moved to New York, because it just made the most sense. I'm really good at hospitality. I'm really good at taking care of people and entertaining them and making good drinks and talking about food. Like, I love it. And it's also like, you know, acts of service is one of my love languages that I speak. Like, I love to feed people. I love to create things for people. And my career, as it evolved over the last 12 years in New York, went from behind the bar to working for brands, small and large, to building programming, to running my own bar, to speaking on panels about diversity and equity and inclusion, to doing work in the non-alcoholic space, because there's a lot of conversations that need to continue happening around substance abuse in the industry. But these are things that I'm deeply passionate about, that I love, that I care about, that come from the core of my humanity. As much as I love making cocktails and as much as I love getting super weird and creative, like science lab in my house or behind a bar, that's like kind of a fringe part of it, right? The DE&I education really started in the bar world for me, I want to say like 3 years ago, 4 years ago, in more of a public facing role, you know, speaking on these panels at cocktail conventions. And that was super cool. But I've always been screaming about this. I've always been the one who has been like, there are so many problems with this. So 86 The Barrier was actually crafted as an emergency response program when COVID hit. Basically what we saw was the shutdown citywide of the restaurant industry, right? The restaurant industry, not just in New York, but everywhere, is built upon the backs of exploited immigrant labor. Immigrants are constantly pigeonholed into unsafe situations, into toxic and abusive situations, into situations that do not benefit them financially, that they still need to stay in order to survive here or elsewhere. But when you look at coastal cities, because we are immigration hubs, the ratio of immigrant labor to citizen labor is like so much higher. So what I started looking at was the fact that people who do not speak English or speak English well will be the last people who can come out of a shutdown and succeed in an oversaturated job market. And we have already lost thousands of restaurants, job creating spaces in New York City, just in New York City alone. And the racism and inherent language bias and discrimination that exists based on language bias in hospitality pretty much guarantees that a white person or somebody who speaks English perfectly, who is potentially less skilled than a non-English fluent person, they're gonna get the job first. So you couple that scarcity based on the pandemic with the fact that there are prolific bars and restaurants that have Spanish speaking barbacks who have been stuck in that lower paying position for almost a decade. And what this directly translates to is a lack of financial independence. So people are prevented from spending in alignment with their values, which means they are limited from reinvesting in themselves, in their families, and thus their communities. So somebody, this 9-year barback, could have a very entrepreneurial mindset. Maybe he wants to own his own bar, but because he makes a significant percentage less than the white bartenders that are coming in and out that can just get the job because they have the look and they have the language, he will always be playing catch up. He will not be able to get ahead. And so my business partner, Cameron Shaw, who she's just been doing magnificent work. She and I were very aligned on this, and we had like a coffee date around like the end of April. And we were chatting about all of this, and I was kind of noodling on it. And I went back to her like April 30th or May 1st. And I was like, I have this idea. What if we form a coalition that is native Spanish speakers that are in our industry, in our community, who are unemployed right now, and we start building a program to offer free peer-to-peer language learning. And it's designed by and for the hospitality industry. And we did it. She was like, yes. So May 1st, 86 The Barrier was born. We basically did a gigantic yes and to that. So the larger goals now, we're in pursuit of our 501c3 certification, which is great, working with fantastic people on that. We have a leadership team of four. We have several teaching partners who are in the industry who are working with students who we refer to as compañeros, because we're trying to flatten that hierarchy between like teacher, student, as opposed to partner, compañero. Right. We have an existing English as a new language curriculum that is probably one of the most in-depth and thorough things I've ever seen in my life. Shout out to Stephanie Ortiz, who is, she's our director of research and curriculum development. We are about to launch a Spanish as a new language curriculum to run parallel with that, because we have a ton of English speakers who are going, wait a minute, I need to be part of this. I need to learn how to speak Spanish. It can't just be the Spanish speaker is learning to speak English, because what we're about in terms of decolonization of language and hospitality is identifying where the blind spots and where the racism exists. There is nothing wrong with somebody who does not speak English. There is nothing that needs to be fixed. So how do we all together navigate unjust systems that are designed to oppress and exploit non-English speaking labor? And part of that is meeting everybody in the middle. Everybody should have functioning Spanglish to go to work with. Frankly, it is the people who are bilingual, trilingual, multilingual, our immigrant labor force. They are the superheroes. It's all the single language, single vernacular English speakers who need to step up our game. And so what we are actually hoping to do in the long term is end up with our programming existing in multiple cities. We're working on several partnerships right now from coast to coast. And we're hoping to create a cultural seismic shift that humanizes the people without whom our industry would not exist. And that's, you know, that's a, like a lifetime's commitment of work, because part of it is anti-racism and anti-classism. And part of it is education. And part of it is breaking down systems and breaking down barriers, you know, hence the term 86, the barrier. So that's, yeah, it's a lot. And Cameron and I just kind of are working hard and digging as deep as we can and trying to be the best that we know how to be as we build this thing. So,
yeah, I mean, as you were talking through all of that, I worked in the service industry for, I don't know, my 20s, I couldn't even count. And you just think that is how it is. It is completely segregated. It is a segregated system in terms of who has opportunity and who doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, that's the thing about where we live. Everything is still segregated. Every system, yeah. Broadway is, you know, all of these places are, the restaurants, the schools, obviously, all of these things are, we're still working our way out of that. I love that you brought up the decolonization of language, because when I was on the 86 The Barrier website, I saw that and I was like, ooh, I want to know more about that. And what it sounds like to me, well, I don't want to say, you tell me, what it means to decolonize language. And I guess a follow-up question to that is there a way we can do that in our own lives, even if we're not part of the restaurant industry?
Yes, yes. So colonization is a full body experience. It is not just physical harm, spiritual harm, religious assimilation, economic violence. It is a perfect storm of all those things. And language is one of the most insidious weapons used to colonize, used to demean, to dehumanize. There's not a single person who has not seen an immigrant made fun of for their accent. I grew up listening to my Chinese grandmother and my Chinese family get made fun of because of their broken English. And when we dehumanize other people, because you have to choose to dehumanize someone in order to feel good about making fun of them, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing with like rape jokes, you know? Mm-hmm. You have to be willing to dehumanize a woman mm-hmm. to make a joke about rape. And that, you know, you've shown that you are willing to do that. So the English language is the single greatest barrier to entry to success in the United States. The English language is also a hodgepodge of so many different global languages, words okay. that we've kind of like plucked and assimilated. And, you know, it is in so many ways the language of oppression. So when we talk about decolonization, we're not just talking about seeing an equal spread of ethnic backgrounds between the front of the house and the back of the house. We're not just talking about changing the mindset from assuming a dishwasher is Mexican and a bartender is white. It's not just about that. It is about what is the language immersion that I need to come to expect when I go to a restaurant that is not necessarily a Spanish-speaking restaurant. You know, when I go to Per Se and have dinner, or when I go to La Bernadette, I want to hear multiple languages and not just the languages of colonizers. I want to hear the languages of brown people that are vilified because they come from brown people. You know, like right. That's what I want to hear. So in terms of what we can do as individuals, that's unfair. Thinking in terms of New York City, because that is where I live right now, but even in my hometown, like Kalamazoo, Michigan, lots of Spanish speakers in Kalamazoo, Michigan, lots of Chinese immigrants in Kalamazoo, Michigan. But thinking in terms of New York, I have made it very important to me to have functional enough Spanish that I can greet the owner of the bodega down the block mm-hmm. in his own language. So that I can, like, I was at a Korean owned grocery store that has a lot of Spanish speaking folks working in like the butcher area and the cheese section and like all these things. And it's important to me to, instead of going up and asking for what I need in English, it's very simple to learn how to go, hola, ¿cómo estás hoy? You know, like that's not hard.
Right.
And so we can all commit to doing those things. Duolingo is free. So like
yes, yeah.
You can take 10 minutes out of your day and go, how do I ask for these things? Let it be an exploratory adventure. And it doesn't have to just be Spanish. It can be Mandarin. It can be French. It can be Italian, you know, all these things. But Spanish, since it's the second language of America, I think is the most crucial to kind of pay attention to right now. So like learning to communicate with the people around us, like
simple.
It's simple. And I'm sorry, the same amount of energy that it takes a person to craft a caption for their social media feed can also be used to spend a couple minutes on the app learning how to say, hey, hello, how are you today? May I please have X, Y, and Z?
Yes. And as you're saying this, I'm thinking of so many interactions we've had in New York, and I'm thinking about why someone might not do that, right? Mm-hmm. Why would someone, and not from like a bigoted or racist standpoint, but why would a well-meaning person not learn that? Mm-hmm. And do you think there's something in there in our, you know, in for English only speakers mm-hmm. that is like, I don't want to mess up or I don't want to be offensive. Is this offensive? I mean, even as I'm thinking through like what would prevent someone from doing that, it almost feels like I'm being like colonized, like not like I'm colonized, but like the colonized thinking is happening within me of like, why would it be offensive to speak in someone's language? And I, as I follow that through, I'm like, because we've grown up with people making fun of immigrants.
Yes.
Like that's the connection, right? It's like, so we almost have to relearn how to be human with other humans.
Literally could not have said that better myself. Yeah, it's, you know, we've grown up watching people get made fun of for their accents and for their broken English. So if I'm speaking broken Spanish to somebody, I fight this every day where like I am very self-conscious about my lack of Spanish skills, even though I'm working on them, I'm self-conscious about it because there is that inherent fear that you will feel what you've seen inflicted on other people. There's a cleaning lady at my gym who I don't know how this started, but one day she was in the locker room and I was in the locker room and we started a conversation and she like barely speaks English. And it's a dialect that I'm struggling with, but every time I see her, we have a little bit of a conversation and right. My Spanish gets better. And she like picks on me and she like compliments me and she's super sweet, but she's incredibly gracious because there are times when she says something really fast and it takes me a minute to catch up. And then I kind of stumble through a response, but she just by existing has created a safe space for me to confront not only my lack of language skills, but also my fear about doing it wrong. Right. And I think that a lot of well-meaning people are like, I just really want to do this right because I want to show respect to the person that I'm talking to. But also there is that fear of the mockery and the bias that exists from somebody who doesn't speak a language perfectly because we have grown up with that as the norm. So right. You're right.
it's again, that white supremacist thinking that perfection is held up high.
Perfection, purity and yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's like, it is a vulnerable thing to say like, I don't have all of it. Let me try.
Yes.
And it's a vulnerable thing that immigrant communities who are non-English speaking communities are doing every single day. So
and they
like
do it to survive. I don't have to speak Spanish to survive here.
Right.
They must speak English in order to survive.
Right.
That's not fair.
I mean, it's just not where I want to live. Like, I don't want to live like that. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Like I've spent time in the Caribbean islands. I've spent time in Mexico. And I remember it's such a privilege because I could still wander around Mexico City by myself, speaking a little bit of Spanish, but I didn't need it to survive.
Right.
Like what?
Right.
That's privilege.
I remember the before times and when
BC
when I would be on the subway platform and someone would come up to me and ask me something in Spanish, thinking, by the way that I looked, that I would speak Spanish.
Yeah.
And feeling like I'm part of the problem. like, oh my gosh. And then what I would do is be like, no hablo español. As I'm speaking a little, like, my mom is actually a high school, now retired high school Spanish teacher. Mm-hmm. I can pick it up. I'm not fluent. I'm not great, but I can help you get to Columbus Circle, you know?
Yeah.
And I'd always feel this tension with just like, especially with directions, like I don't want to send someone to Brooklyn if they're trying to go to Queens. What am I saying? But I felt disconnected as an English speaker from my community, because one of the things that I love about living in New York is giving someone directions.
Yes.
Like that's what makes you a New Yorker. No. Don't take the L, take the Q up, down, you know, and again, like not in an egoic sense of like, I wanted to do the right thing. Like I'm being, you know, cheeky about that.
The fabric of our city.
Yeah. And being able to like, this is why we're here. You know, if we could live, I mean, again, it's immense privilege to be like, we could live anywhere because some people can't leave New York and want to leave New York.
Yeah.
We want to be here. Part of it is because we are completely enriched by being around the diversity that's here. Mm-hmm. And like, we have a daughter that, you know, who knows, maybe we'll move eventually. I don't know, not anytime soon, but like, we want her to grow up in New York. We want her to grow up knowing that she's one of 7 billion people.
Yeah.
And she's great, but she's one of 7 billion, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, beyond just the restaurant industry, obviously this podcast is a lot about art and art making and independent art making and breaking into systems so that you can break them down from the inside out. Yes. And one of the things that I find to be very true and frustrating is within the arts community, there's a lot to fix. And
so many things to fix and endlessly.
And I feel like people misunderstand. I feel like I misunderstand a lot of times representation and inclusivity in the arts and for arts workers. And I'm wondering if you feel like there's one particular thing that we all just misunderstand about representation and inclusivity in this industry that you wish people would get.
Yeah, I think we look at the product and not the root system first. Mm-hmm. The actors that you see on screen, on stage, are the final piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. We are the tips of the leaves on the tree of a show. What I wish people understood was the power of economy and who holds that power. Because the people who control the purse strings, both at the commercial level, but also at the regional level, mm-hmm. and in the nonprofit sector, the people who control the purse strings control the narratives. So I wish people understood more, and this is definitely happening, like communities of color in the industry have for years now been going, wait a minute. I wish people en masse understood the absolute power of having more female identifying producers and female identifying producers of color. Because for as long as we have cis white males controlling millions upon millions of dollars in funding for these commercial shows, we are going to continue to see things like an all white Music Man revival. We are going to continue to see things that are produced through the lens of a cis white man, sometimes those who think they're woke and think they know things. And we are going to have a fatal gap in understanding what happens between the tokenization of a cast of color and why they're there and the power of money. My biggest beef with a lot of conservatory programs is they crank out these artists who are so eager and passionate, who have no sense of how the economy works. And not just the microcosm of the theatrical industry and the entertainment industry, like our sub-economy, but the economy en masse. Mm-hmm. Because the economy is what drives, economy drives culture and culture drives economy in lots of ways. But when the same core group of people control the economy,
right,
we're limited. As
you're talking about that, I was thinking like, okay, so what if there were like still all these cis white men producing, but then that was like 10%, and then there's 10% Black women and 10% Indigenous women, and then if there was an equal playing field, would we choose the all white Music Man, or would we be like, there's something like, let that be the free market then? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, exactly. It's like,
let's see. And we've seen time and time again, specifically in the film industry, that pieces that are produced by, written, directed by, starring people of color,
yeah,
do really well at the box office.
Really fucking well. They do. And everybody always stands back and goes, oh my God, I can't believe. And all the people of color are going, yeah, I could believe that.
Yeah, Black of course. Panther,
Crazy Rich Asians, you know, like, and yeah, it's the inherent racism that kind of keeps that narrative from spreading, that belief, that trust in narratives of color.
Yeah.
But also, I would love to see just Asian people on screen, not as a commentary about how Asian people can act. Yes. Just put up on screen. I'm sorry, yes, as an Asian person, I'm a really good actor, and it doesn't necessarily stem from just the fact that I'm Asian. Like,
yeah.
It's enraging.
Well, that's what you're saying about the tokenism in a way, right? It's like let's put people of color on screen so that people know that this white team
is woke. Is,
yeah.
A which is like, a lot of words, and words are great and social media statements are great. But like when you think about this is the scarcity mindset that I'm talking about. people automatically assume white supremacy has taught us that there's only room for a small handful at the top. Mm-hmm. So it creates this crabs in a barrel, survival instinct driven scarcity mentality where all of a sudden, you know, white actors are feeling like they're being replaced by actors who are in Hamilton. Hamilton is, I don't care how many productions of Hamilton are running around the world. That is a small microcosm of the amount of theater that is getting produced nationally and globally. But this replacement mentality, you can have Lin-Manuel Miranda next to Stephen Sondheim, and one of them does not take away from the other. You know what that does? Creates jobs.
Right.
It creates jobs. Right. So let's say, you know, taking the model that you just referenced, let's say we have, you know, we have out of 100, you know, commercial producers, we've got 10 white dudes, we've got 10 black women, 10 black men, 10 Asians, 10 indigenous, they deserve 20 indigenous people, because dear God, you know, 10 Latin producers, you know, what, like, what does that do other than create a competition for real estate? Because that's the only thing that's really limited. There's a limited amount of Broadway. Right. There's a limited amount of regional houses. But what that does is open up the floodgates for shows to create jobs. There's no, it's,
Well, and this is, and we can't even go there because like not enough time in the day, but like, this is why capitalism and racism work hand in glove, right? Because like we're saying there's a free market, but no, there's not. There's a free market for a couple of people who hold on to the power, who aren't going to give up the power and are going to make all these rules and expectations based on them maintaining the power. And we're going to like, yeah, fight amongst ourselves for, for peanuts or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's fascinating and infuriating and horrible and inspiring, because I do think that like there are people that are, you know, like you and like Kimberly that I mentioned, like who are doing this really good work to look. One group is not going to be the only solution. We need all of these groups. We need all of these coalitions. We need a wave. We need, you know, so that, but by the time my daughter's 18, she's like, what was going on in 2021? And we're like, oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it was crazy. You know, like she just doesn't understand how it could be that way.
Yes.
And I guess I'm wondering too, like, you know, for people who are trying to break into acting or the theater and film industry specifically, what, and they're, and they want to find their place and they don't necessarily want to just like, they can't necessarily stomach, you know, being 20 to 30,000 followers deep on Instagram because they paid for whatever and they're thirst trapping or whatever, whatever. Right. What is your advice to people who are struggling to break in, want to be a part of it, want to act, want to direct or write or, you know, make their film or do what they want to do, but they also see the issues underlying in the system? How do they find their place?
I think if the notion of, quote, their place has been created by oppressors, then that's not a place for them. They need to create their own place. I am really not a fan of any place that is given to me by someone whose ethos I do not respect. And a huge part of this, a huge part of figuring out why you want to act and why you want to pursue certain work and why you've chosen this incredibly difficult career path over others is knowing who the fuck you are. And it took me the first, my God, 8 years of my career here in New York to figure out who I was. And part of figuring out who you are is saying no to all the things that don't work and understanding that you must love multiple things inside and outside arts and entertainment in order to bring your full holistic self to choosing the work that you want to do. I technically left musical theater at the end of 2020 because they don't write roles for people like me. I'm a classically trained soprano who is about to age out of the ingenue look, who also has like short hair, is an athlete, is funny, is really smart, and refuses to dumb that down on stage. And I curse a lot. I'm not getting cast as the ingenue. I haven't gotten cast as the ingenue in a very long time, but I'm not quote unquote old enough to play like Diana in Next to Normal. And I don't like what's available to me in Hamilton necessarily. I don't like what's available to me in contemporary musical theater canon. Are those roles fun? Yes. Are they semi-compelling? Sure. But I've never had a place, quote unquote, place for me in theater. Television and film is a whole different thing. So yeah. I did like a year-long examination of what I want to say, who I want to work with, how I want to work, what do I want to work on. Now, I do have a theatrical contract that's coming up that's starting at the end of the year. And I had a lengthy discussion with the producer who called me to offer me this role. And she's like, we've been watching you for a really long time. We've been trying to get you involved. I know the schedule hasn't worked out. Just would really love to have you be part of this family. And she outlined her plan for the show's trajectory, giving me like some financial details and some like behind the scenes details. And there was so much respect with the way that she showed up for me. And mind you, this is just an ensemble track. She didn't offer me the lead. And the way that I was treated by this powerhouse female producer, I was like, I left this part of the industry and it felt like saying goodbye to a part of the world that never wanted me in the first place. Mm-hmm. But I will absolutely say yes to something like this because we are on the same page. But I had to figure out who I was, and I had to figure out that I make my places for me. Nobody else gets to determine that. Nobody else gets to determine how Asian I am. Nobody else gets to determine whether or not I'm allowed to be funny or sharp, or I'm allowed to like punch someone on screen. Well, they are allowed to determine that. But you know, it's about, this industry makes us diminish ourselves in order to fit into compartmentalized boxes so that we are easily consumable by white gatekeepers. So for anybody who's thinking about trying to get into acting and examining the mechanics of doing so, and emotionally the mechanics of doing so, because it's a heavy emotional lift at all times, it cannot start from what will I get permission to do? Because you're dead in the water. It must start from what do I want? What do I want to make people feel? Who am I creating for? For me, I'm creating for the little mixed race Asian girls that are looking at their screen and seeing themselves, that are looking up on stage and seeing themselves. I create for little me and for all of the women who have been pigeonholed into subservient roles. And it has to start with that. If it starts with trying to adhere to a permission structure that was never built to serve you, you got to go back to the drawing board, because your art will never be true to who you are, or it will be very, very delayed in becoming true to who you are because we evolve as humans. Right. That was a long-winded answer, but I do truly think that that's what it takes.
No, you know, I think it was actually what you said brought up a lot of memories for me that I totally forgot about. Like, you know, I am a white woman with all the privileges that come with being just white, mm-hmm. working in a white space. Yeah. So I'm not in any way trying to compare experience. I just remember being at a class at Actors Connection mm-hmm. with an agent. Mm-hmm. So first of all, a classist kind of structure where I needed to work enough hours at the bar to be able to afford this plus my rent, plus my groceries yeah. to get into this room where an agent, and he was white. Assume he still is. could give me feedback. Uh-huh. I didn't really know if the feedback I was going to get was going to be valuable to me, but presumably the real idea was to get an agent out of it. Like for him to be like, oh, you're great. Come on board. Yeah. And I remember getting feedback from him. I forget what I sang, but it was something funny. I mean, you know, it was supposed to be funny. And he looked at me and goes, oh, you know, it's really difficult with you because you're pretty, but you're funny. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I was like, I have nothing to say. And then he got confused by it, looked at my resume, saw that I had done multiple comedic roles.
Yeah.
Still was very confused.
Yeah.
And I was like, you telling me this is not flattering, is not nice, is so diminishing, like you said. And why am I paying for this?
Yes.
And I just remember the feeling that that created in me. Again, someone who moves through this space with privilege.
Yeah.
100%. And if I'm feeling that, then I can only imagine like what the degrees are out from that very safe spot that I was in. Mm-hmm. Because it felt like I did not belong. I was never going to get an agent. I was never going
to
find someone.
A problem to be solved.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I always felt like that in auditions. I always felt like, I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know why I'm here. And if someone had said to me what you said, you know, when I was 22, maybe I wouldn't get it because I was 22 and I was like, nah, I know better. And you kind of have to live your life. But I feel like that would have been so helpful. And it's actually still helpful for me to hear as you know, an artist working in this new segment of my life. Yeah. But I do think, again, that is kind of, I mean, I don't know if you'd call it decolonizing or not.
Yes.
But it is unhooking yourself from the illusion of power in a system that was built to keep you away from power.
Yep. That right there.
Yeah. You know, and that, I mean, that's what's really exciting to me this year, though, because I do feel like there are a lot of independent artists doing a lot of independent work. You know, I don't know, are you someone, I don't know this at all. So I don't think my research on you brought anything up on this, but are you someone who you want to write things or produce things, or are you staying in that lane of like, I'm the actor that you're going to go to, in film and TV, maybe not so much theater?
I love that question because I have such deep admiration and respect for people who can write and create their own work. That is not a skill set that is either in my wheelhouse or one I'm interested in cultivating.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have produced things before, and I do enjoy producing, especially for like charity and things like mm-hmm. that. Like I love producing events and concerts and things. But the opportunity that COVID gave me was to really, really dig into not only what I'm good at, but what I want to be good at. And what I want to be good at is, and this is something that I've always loved, is being an interpretive artist as opposed to a creative artist, because I think they're different things. There's intersectionality, but I really find so much joy in being the vessel for someone's brilliant words and brilliant music. So, you know, the pilot that I'm about to start shooting is something that I'm deeply passionate about because it's like a fantasy piece, you mm-hmm. know, and it's like a powerful woman who is just breaking all the rules. I want to be of service to that narrative so right. that when this thing is on screen, people see me and go, oh shit, I didn't know that was possible, you know, and things like Shakespeare, mm-hmm. There's so much room for rule breaking and interpretation in Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. There's a reason it has lasted for centuries. So in terms of my career, when I'm focusing on mostly straight plays and television and film, I really love being the vessel for those words. I don't need to be in charge of creating something new from scratch. I could do that. I don't want to do that because I understand where my power lies. It's kind of like, you know, am I really good at marching in the streets and protesting? Sure. Is that where I'm the most valuable? No, I'm the most valuable when I can use my words as weapons and when I can galvanize, when I can organize, you know? So it's really been a gift because I feel like I've done the opposite of what a lot of people have. Mm-hmm. when COVID happened, people were like, oh my God, I got to make my own work. I got to do this stuff. And very often against their own instincts. Mm-hmm. Whereas I just refused to do that. And I kind of just stepped back and was like, I would like to invest in what makes my heart pound. And what makes my heart pound is stuff that I can sink my teeth into that I did not have the responsibility of creating. And through that, choosing to work with collaborators who do value my opinion about something, about lyrics, about punctuation, about interpretation. That's where I shine.
Right.
So yeah, what, no, I don't want to write my own stuff. I'm not good.
I think that is so, and obviously it's a snow day because you can hear the plow or whatever, the snowblower in my backyard. I think it's so important for people to hear because not everyone wants to create work, but I think people still want to be collaborating. And I think people still want a place for them that feels like, as you said, the right place for them. And they don't want to just be like, well, I want to be an actor, but I don't really feel like there's a place for me on Broadway. So it's like, no, you can still be an actor. Like there are people working on things. And the truth of like true coalition building, from what I understand of it, at least, is that we need people in every spot.
Yes.
We don't need just writer directors. We don't need just actors. We don't need just producers. We need everyone. Yes. We don't need just audience members. We need everyone to be of that mindset. So if you can bring that ethos and that mission to wherever your skills are, like you're part of the solution.
Yeah. And it enables you to be such a better team player.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like when I'm in a rehearsal room, one of my favorite things about being in a rehearsal room is the team player aspect. Cause it's not just about how well am I delivering my lines? It's how am I showing up for the people on stage with me? How well am I showing up in respect and diligence for the people backstage who are helping me fucking look good? Yeah. How am I showing up in respect and honor of the time and energy of the creative team and the writer if they're in the room? And knowing I don't think it diminishes your value to know your place in the team. If you're approaching it with integrity and with passion and with empathy, you know what I mean? That makes the team, it, like high tides raise all ships. Right. So everyone knows where their arrow is pointing. That makes the overall process better and like more joyful and more creative and more inspiring to the audience. Like, yes, all of that. I got excited.
me too. well, we're just about out of time. I want to be respectful of your time. One last question that I just want to ask you so we can end we could have ended on that high note, but a second high note. And again, my daughter just woke up from the nap. There's a plow back here. So this is truly independent podcasting at its best.
I love it. Thank God.
What right now gives you hope?
I am given so much hope by watching all of the people who have been systematically excluded from so many things in life, stand up and acknowledge their fear and their sense of scarcity and claim their own power and agency anyways. And this is not just artists, this is people across the country, across the economic spectrum, across the political spectrum, across the educational spectrum. I am so hopeful when I see people choosing to treat themselves with a respect that has never been given to them. That makes me like stress sweat with joy. because
I love it.
The people who refuse to say yes to oppression are the ones who are going to change our world for the better. And we can all learn from each other. We can all learn from that.
100%. Yeah. That's a great high, high note.
And that's high note. That is the B flat of answers.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Oh my God, this is great.
And that's Joanna Carpenter. See? She's awesome. Just a delight. I hope you really enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoyed talking with Joanna. All of her information on where to find her and 86 The Barrier and everything will be in the show notes. So take a look down there. Please follow her and what she's doing, what she's working on. And if you enjoyed this episode, the very best thing that you could do is rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And if you've already done that, sharing on social is also an amazing thing that we are so grateful for. And yeah, I think that's all I want to say. I hope you are having a great day, and I'll talk to you soon.